Minutes tuned to yesterday, featuring programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, True History. Later on, the series Ports of Call from 1936. But first, a broadcast of Vox Pop, a CBS episode from July 16, 1945, at the Lake Placid Club.
The show that travels America to bring you the voice of the people, thanks to the makers of
Bromo Seltzer.
Tonight, Bromo Seltzer's Vox Pop train travels to the famous Lake Placid Club, high up in the Adirondack Mountains, where we'll hear from American soldiers recently liberated from enemy prison camps and other overseas veterans who are enjoying 2 weeks of fun and relaxation as guests of the Army. And here are your two Vox Poppers, Ed Sullivan and Peter Donald, pinch hitting for Parks Johnson and Warren Hull, who are on vacation. Come in, Lake Placid, New York.
This is Ed Sullivan.
And this is Peter Donald. And Ed, in all my born days, I've never seen anything quite as exciting as this Lake Placid Club version of the story of G.I. Joe.
You know, Peter, that lobby out there is actually bringing headlines to life. Instead of communiques, the shoulder patches of the 1st Army, the Rangers, the 77th Division.
Yes, sir, and there was the 36th Division, the Greenland Command, the CBI Theater.
And you forgot the 28th from Pennsylvania and the Yankee Division and... By the way, here's a youngster from MacArthur's command. From Bridgeport, Connecticut, Corporal Bill Thomas. Bill, it's very nice to have you on the program tonight. Where did you win that Purple Heart?
I got my Purple Heart on Lady in the Philippines.
From Lady in the Philippines? Then you were with MacArthur's outfit, huh?
We were attached to the 32nd Division as a wire communications unit.
Well, exactly what did that call for? What did you have to do?
Well, our job was to put in wire communications right after the infantry had cleaned out its fight.
Telephone wires and...
That's right, telephone, telegraph, and teletype.
Well, on that particular telephone call, you got the wrong number, huh?
You're not kidding. I wish I could have reversed the charges.
Up in Bridgeport, what did you do?
I was a projectionist in Rialto Theater.
Rialto Theater? Did you play vaudeville up there?
Yeah, we had a few shows. I ran a spotlight for them.
You ran the spotlight, and then you got over, an axe would... You're not the fellow who killed vaudeville by any chance, are you?
Not quite, no.
Now, Bill, when you were in the hospital at Lady, what were you thinking about?
Well, the first thing I thought about was getting home and seeing the folks and meeting Sandy again.
Meeting Sandy again? Who exactly is Sandy?
Edward, my boy, here is Sandy herself. We'd like everybody to meet her. Miss Sandra Chaper. Here she is. Very, very lovely brunette lady. Sandy, did you by any chance think of Bill while he was away at all?
No, not at all.
Not at all, huh? You got her fingers crossed. Tell me a little bit, how did this romance of yours start? Was it in the mountains with the moonlight or in a canoe or something? How did it start?
Oh, over an argument over a nickel.
It started in an argument over a nickel. Where did that happen?
Nut house.
In the what?
Nut house.
In the nut house? Oh, you were working in a store selling nuts.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, wait a minute. Got to straighten that out. He came in for a pound of cashews, yeah.
And, they were 80 cents and a half pound. Bill tried to tell me they were 75 and we had an argument.
You had an argument. Mm-hmm. And that got you together, got you to know each other?
Uh-huh.
And you haven't had any arguments ever since. Everything's been going pretty good, huh?
That's perfect.
Perfect. That's swell. And the look in her eyes when she says that. That's really a new Hollywood story, Ed. Boy meets girl, girl sells nuts, boy goes nuts over girl. Well, and here you are, two mighty swell young people. Ed, what do you think we ought to do with them?
Well, I was thinking, Peter, you know, Bill says that he's always kept thinking of getting married to Sandy. Well, Sandy, I'll tell you. You see that door over there, right over there? Well, you take your Sandy through that door, and inside you'll find yourself in the post chapel. And in that chapel, Bill, the chaplain, Father Bernard Carl, is waiting to marry you two youngsters, so... You'll have all the trimmings. Vox Pop is brought up from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Your mother, and Sandy, we brought up your mother and dad, and your two sisters, Helen and Anna, for your bridal party. When the two of you kids are married, you come on back and rejoin Peter and me right here on the stage. There they go into the chapel. And you know, know, Peter, that just about completes the memory I'll always have of this place. Turned over to the Army to give these VR returnees $1 million vacation.
Yes, sir. I've never seen anything equal this area. Summer resort that even has ice skating for these guys.
With their wives up here for 2 weeks as the Army guests. They, you know, they've got everything. Golf, tennis, hayride.
Yeah, and they've even got a big day and night club downstairs, the Copacetic.
I was down there.
And they've got Army floor shows and movies, the whole works. But, look, how about letting our Vox Pop audience meet some more of these returnees? Who's next, Ed?
Well, a tank gunner from the Battle of the Bulge. From New York City, Private First Class Arthur Homer. Arthur, what part of New York do you come from?
From the Bronx, Ed.
From the Bronx?
That's right.
Well, you got some Bronx people out there, and I suppose that these mountains up here and lakes of Lake Placid remind you of your native Bronx, don't they?
Oh, they sure do.
Are you married?
Yes, I am, Ed.
You know, I've got the darndest suspicion. I've met you someplace before.
That's right. You on the boat that docked, you were at the boat when we docked the 5th of May on the SS Argentina.
The Argentina, yeah. We went over to Carousel, then later over to Kilmer.
That's right. And I've also seen you at Madison Square Garden at the Harvest Moon Ball.
We'll have you dancing back there one of these days. Now, what outfit were you with?
I was with the 707th Tank Battalion attached to the 28th Division.
And what did you do in that tank?
Well, I was a tank gunner.
Mm-hmm. Civilian life, what did you do?
I was a clerk at the Forest Hotel on 49th Street in Brooklyn.
A hotel clerk became a tank gunner? How did that work out?
Well, I tell you, Ed, when I was examined at Fort Jay, I spoke to the doctor confidentially.
Uh-huh.
I told him that I had bad feet.
Oh, I see. And was he sympathetic?
Yes, I imagine he was because he gave me a tank of my own to ride in instead of hike.
Oh, I see. All for your little bad feet. Now, where was your first combat?
Well, that was up in Belgium, and then we fought up in Hurtgen Forest, and then down to Luxembourg.
That was in the Battle of the Bulge.
That's right. That's where I was captured. December 17th.
December 17th?
That's right.
When you were a prisoner on Christmas Day?
That's correct.
You remember it?
Oh, it's a horrible Christmas that I'll never forget. It was the third day we had gone without food or water in the boxcars.
Some of your fellows wounded, I suppose?
Yes, there were some wounded, and all I kept thinking of was how I wished I could be home. Mm-hmm. All the turkey dinners, Christmas trees, see the tree in Radio City, all the lights on Broadway, and hear my wife wish me a Merry Christmas.
I was in a boxcar on Christmas Day. Was that your first Christmas over there?
That's true.
Now, where did you go to? Bad Orb?
That's right. We went to Bad Orb, which was Kellogg 9B.
How long were you there?
3.5 months.
How'd you fellas, in 3.5 months, how'd you entertain yourselves?
Well, most all of us, for our hobbies, we copied menus and recipes.
Well, you're hungry, huh?
That's right. We always had our minds on food.
Sort of made up imaginary meals?
That's right. Imaginary meals and menus.
And what was your favorite meal?
Well, I was a breakfast specialist.
You were a breakfast specialist, huh?
That's right.
What was your favorite breakfast?
My favorite breakfast consisted of a hot cake.
One hot cake?
Covered by a fried egg.
One fried egg on top of the hot cake.
Covered by a hot cake.
Another hot cake.
And another fried egg.
Another egg.
And then another hot cake.
A third hot cake?
Oh, yes. And then the third fried egg.
Another fried egg on top of that, huh?
Lots of butter, syrup, surrounded by sausage.
Oh, you are, as a civilian, you are really killing me. Well, now, after those big imaginary meals, you must have put on a lot of weight. How did you reduce?
Well, we sang songs.
What kind of songs? Hit parade songs?
Well, it was our hit parade song. It was a song called Come and Get Us, Georgie Pat.
What tune did you sing to that day?
To the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
How'd it go?
Come and get us, Georgie Patton. Come and get us, Georgie Patton.
And finally, you sang so loud or so bad that Georgie finally came and got you?
That's right. The second day of April.
Well, it's wonderful to have you home again. What are your post-war plans?
Well, my post-war plans, I'd like to own a liquor store up in the Bronx near the Yankee Stadium.
You mean one tanker looking for more tankers, is that it?
Oh, that's what I'd want. Lots of tankers.
Well, I don't know if we can get a tanker for you, but Bromo Seltzer has for you, Arthur. First, for your everyday use, here's a very rare gift, a fine electric razor. And for your home, grab the collection you've already started, that we heard you started. We have this fine antique porcelain figurine of a Chinese mandarin, a signed piece, by the way. And for your wife, who's here at Lake Placid with you, some really yummy wool sweaters, one coral and one lime, a brown wool skirt, and a navy blue cardigan sweater of pure soft cashmere. Thank you very, very much. Arthur.
Thank you very much.
Back at the Lake Placid Army Ground and Service Forces redistribution station, I didn't think I was going to say that with these teeth, but we have a fella here who's doing a swell job on the permanent party. From Dedham, Massachusetts, Private First Class Wally Richardson. Wally, how long have you been in the Army?
Oh, I went in on Washington's birthday in 44.
On Washington? That's a fine way to celebrate a national holiday. I see. Well, our little spies report that another American soldier is having a birthday today. You wouldn't know who that would be, would you?
No, I haven't the least idea.
No, it's Wally Richardson. He's having a birthday. How about that, huh? Ed, would you like to sing a little happy birthday to you, to Wally?
Well, I'd love to,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, please do.
Happy birthday to
Thank you, Ed Sullivan. All right, fine. Tell me, Wally, what outfit were you with, please?
I was with the 9th Division.
I see. You were a prisoner of war yourself,
That's
weren't you? Who captured you? How did it happen?
I was captured by a smiling German lieutenant.
Oh, smiling?
Mm.
Laughing on the other side of their faces now, I guess. But what did he say to you when he captured
you? Well, in nice English, he said, okay, boys, it's all over, let's go.
He spoke English?
Oh, yes, very well.
How'd that happen?
Well, he happened to be a hotel manager in England before the war.
Have you seen any smiling hotel managers since you've been back in the States?
Not like that Lake Placid.
That's just about it. And we know that you were taken from Bonn to Limburg. You lost a little weight there, didn't
you? Yes, I lost about 40 pounds in 30 days.
That's quite a load. Have you put it back on?
Well, you can judge.
I see. The food was a little better at Kustrin, wasn't it?
The food wasn't too much better, but the treatment was.
Why was that?
The compound guard, the compound leader, was a prisoner of war during the last war of the Americans.
I see. Well, what did you do for recreation in the prison?
Recreation? We were too darn weak to do any recreation.
Well, how did you pass the time on
it? Well, most of us passed the time by reading the Bible.
You did?
Not so.
Did you have a chaplain with you?
No, we had no chaplains, but a boy by the name of Johnny Sandcock from Virginia and myself acted as acting chaplain while we were there.
Never having done it before, you conducted services,
That's
eh?
Right.
That's grand. Well, tell me, what are you doing at Lake Placid now?
Well, I'm in the educational branch here, discussion leader for the Army orientation program.
Uh-huh. Well, explain that a little bit. How does it work? What do you do exactly?
Well, we try to lead discussions on points of interest that the boys want to discuss, such as the GI Bill of Rights, post-war plans and problems, and we have a sound-off session for them where they can tell us just what they think about the Army.
Oh, you mean they have any complaints, really?
Well, once in a while.
I see. Well, this is a wonderful outfit up here. It's a wonderful job you're all doing to sort of give these guys the old seventh inning stretch before they go back in for the last couple of innings. And I guess you know that it's the best team in the world, don't you?
Yes, it is.
Well, you're all doing a grand job, and because you are, because we're glad to see you, Bromo Seltzer has for you, well, first for your wife, a fine alligator wallet and a bottle of very rare and luscious perfume. This is Chanel Russian leather. How's that? All right? And for you, Wally, well, we hear you're quite a golfer, so we hope you'll enjoy this set of six Sam Snead matched irons made by Wilson, and four matched Gene Sarazen woods with a leather-bound canvas bag to complete the whole outfit. Thank you very much, Private First Class Wally Richardson.
And now from a suburb of Fall River, Massachusetts, another Purple Heart, another returned prisoner of war, Corporal Joe Souza. Joe, what is that name? Is that Souza? Is that Italian?
No, it's Portuguese.
Portuguese? You weren't a Portuguese band leader by the name of Souza, were you?
No.
You married?
I am.
Parents living?
Yeah.
What outfit were you with?
I was the 9th Armored Division.
The 9th Armored. We read a lot about them back here. You were in the Battle of the Bulge. That's where you were overrun and surrounded?
That's right.
Uh-huh. Now, do you remember the day that you were captured by von Rundstedt's men?
Yes, I'll never forget that day, Ed. We was marched down back to the road there, and we passed by the Normandy Highway, where they had these artillery men and also our medics all shot, killed there, and snow almost hadn't covered. I could tell by the Red Cross on the helmet that they were medics.
These are the Americans who were murdered by the Germans,
That's
huh?
That's right.
Now, where'd they take you?
They took us into a stockade.
No, did they treat you that way there?
No, they treated us bad there.
Uh-huh. If I say they treated any of your men get murdered there?
They did. I'll never forget one night when they come in, two lieutenants come in for shoes.
Uh-huh.
They want size 9 and a half.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Size 9 and a half shoes. We all took off our shoes and they took out three men.
We interrupt this program. We have interrupted this program to bring you a special news broadcast from the Pacific. For a special communique from Admiral Nimitz headquarters, we take you now to Guam.
The Pacific Fleet are the battleship HMS King George V and the aircraft carrier HMS Formidable. These combined forces off Japan form the most powerful striking force yet assembled as one unit in the Pacific. I return you to the United States.
This special communique was brought to you by CBS World News. We now resume our scheduled program.
Back at Lake Placid, resuming this interview, the others cut off by that war flash from the Pacific. Now, how did you get out of that camp where they murdered your men?
Well, I got out one night to an irrigation ditch, which led to a bunch of pine trees.
Did you meet any of your other men?
I did. Next morning, I met 15 men.
So now you had 16 men? How did you didn't have any arms?
Aids and guns from the broken-up tanks of ours that we had in the woods.
So now your 16 American kids start for the American lines?
We did.
Did the Belgian people help you?
They did. One night there where I had my feet pretty well froze, this Belgian woman gave me a pair of stockings, black stockings, which I still have at home.
Uh-huh.
And also the doctor, drew us a map how to get back to the American lines.
So with this map, you start out across German-occupied towns and sentry, German sentry-posted bridges. How did you lose many men in that fighting?
We did. We lost everyone except four.
So now out of the original 16, there are four of you boys left, and now this is your last day coming up, and what happened?
That's right.
Well, what happened?
Well, that day was walking down the road, and I was ahead, and I looked up, and we noticed a bunch of men.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what they were at first, so we was pretty well delirious, and we started fighting again.
You four boys against this whole regiment that showed up, huh?
And we ran out our last ammunition, and one Texan fellow that was pretty bad, had his two legs, trench foot, and set in gangrene, and also a fellow Todd from Wisconsin was paralyzed one side, me and the other fellow. And I was out of ammunition. We just took out our knives and went after him. That Texan was ahead.
Older Texan fellow with his on ice led the attack on him. What day was that?
Well, that was on Christmas Day. That was the day I'll never forget.
Christmas Day. And what outfit was that you ran into?
The British outfit.
The British. Well, we're very delighted that the British ran into you, Joe, and glad that you're home. And we understand you're expecting a little Joe or Josephine at your home in a short time. So Bromo Seltzer's having shipped direct from the factory to your wife a fine Whitney baby carriage, and I mean it's a honey. And for you, we have this fine pen and pencil set with solid gold caps on each. And for Mrs. Souza, here's a 17-jewel Kingston wristwatch that we hope she'll treasure for a long time to come. Thank you very, very much, Joe Souza.
Peter Donald, what have you got?
I have another grand GI here, Ed. He's wearer of the Purple Heart and veteran of 110 days in a German prison camp from Merrick, Long Island, Private First Class Robert Moore. Bob, welcome to Vox Pop. You don't mind if I lean on you, do you?
No.
How tall are you, incidentally?
About 5'2".
About 5'2". Of course, up here in Lake Placid, you're about 1,805'2" above sea level, so you're a pretty tall guy. Now, as a matter of fact, I can kid Bobby because... Shall we tell him the last time we met, Bob?
Sure.
We met in school. He was just passing out of the fifth grade and I was flunking out of third year high or something like that. Tell me, what did you do? You went in the movies, didn't you?
Yeah, that's fine. I went out in Hollywood. Try to get a break. I was in Boys Town.
In Boys Town, what'd you play?
Wonder Boys.
I see, that's fine. Did you get on the stage at all?
Yeah, I had to get in the Army to get on Broadway, though.
What show did you do?
This is the Army.
I see. Were you with that? Why did you leave the show?
Well, it was pretty tough, and I thought maybe I could get a softer job, so I ended up in the infantry.
Tell me, what did you do in the infantry?
I was in heavy weapons. I carried a base plate.
You carried the base plate?
Yeah, 81 millimeter mortar.
That's a little big for a guy like you, isn't it?
Slightly.
Did the guys think it was funny?
Yeah, say, hey, Shorty, where's the base plate taking?
And you were captured in the Belgian Bulge, is that right?
That's fine.
How many of there were you at that time?
Well, it was about 300 of us. We're going up this road, and we got cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up another road, and here's a convoy hit a landmine, blew up the Jeep, and killed us, the captains and the driver.
Yeah.
And we gave up then. We found out we were fighting against three Panzer divisions.
Three Panzer divisions against 300 guys. That's pretty good odds with fellas like you. And you were 110 days in prison camp. Who liberated you?
Patton's Army.
Oh, really? Have you seen General Patton at all?
Yes, I saw him once.
Did you speak to him?
No, that guy travels too fast for anybody.
Well, you must learn not to be so snobbish. What are you going to do when you get out of the Army, Bob?
Well, I don't know. I think I'll go back to military school.
Military school? Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do just to see what we can do in the meantime. Bromo Seltzer has for you, Bobby, a couple of things for that all-important young lady back home, which I guess you have. We have a fine gold anklet with tiny, graceful links. You can put your brand on her there, partner. And for you, we have a heavy gold signet ring, pre-war weight, by the way. And to wear around your room during your leisure hours, here is a soft, scotch wool dressing gown and brown and white houndstooth design. Boy, I could use that myself. How do you like that? Okay?
Oh, it's swell.
Well, thanks a lot, Private First Class Robert Moore.
Before the newlyweds come out of the chapel, Peter, let's tell the folk about next week's show.
Righto, Ed. Next week, the Vox Pop train pulls into the Marine Air Base at Cherry Point, North Carolina, where we'll be talking with Marine flyers just back from the Pacific.
Wait a minute, Peter. Here comes the bride and groom.
Oh, look!
Congratulations to both of you youngsters and every wonderful wish. And now, Bromo Seltzer has for you both some gifts we hope you'll enjoy. First for you, Bill, a set of match-grain K. Woody pipes in handsome case. We understand you're quite a smoker. And for you, Sandy, we're having made a beautiful jewel pin that you can wear as a brooch or on a hat. It's made of palladium. You know, that precious metal is so fashionable nowadays in engagement and wedding rings. And it's being designed for you by the famous jeweler, Mark Corrin. I know you love it. And for both of you, we have this beautiful silver service for six in a handsome box. It's National Silver's loveliest pattern. And finally, we found a little place right here in Lake Placid just made for honeymooners. And it's yours and Sandy's for the rest of the summer on Earth. Every wonderful wish. Now, we actually had something else for you that the audience doesn't know about, but I'll tell the audience about it because first I'm going to call him out. We had to get a best man and a matron of honor. So for the best man, we got one of the Columbia Broadcasting System's greatest stars. He's here, and I want him to come out. He's quite a fisherman up here in the mountains. Down home, he is a radio star. Ted Collins. Ted, come on out here.
How are you, Edward? It's nice to see you again.
Well, it's awfully nice to see you again, Ted.
Well, I didn't know that when you invited me over here this afternoon, you were going to have me meet Sandy and Bill here, and I was going to be best man. I just thought you wanted to rent a few cottages around and spend a little bit of money, but I didn't know that I was going to be a best man here.
Not only the best, you are the best man because you lent me a pre-war golf ball to play golf.
Well, thank you, Ed. Did you return it?
I certainly did.
Well, that's the main thing. If you put it back in the bag, everything is all right. Ed, we had a beautiful wedding in there.
Sorry,
we really had a beautiful wedding, and I think that you missed the big highlight of the evening. Don't you think that you had fun, kid?
Darn right.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Now, come on over and speak up. Now you're man and wife. Now you really have to say something. Did you have a good time, Bill?
Best I ever had.
How did you do, Sandy?
I think it's wonderful.
You think it's wonderful? Well, now, what are we going to do from here on in? Ed, do you know what happened to me? You know what happened to me, Ed? When I came in here and I got this job of being the best man, they said, we've got to have a bridesmaid. So I said to Sandy, well, you can get a bridesmaid. There's about 86 women back here. So one of them said, no, I think that we'll have somebody that's very well known because we want to get some pictures taken.
Uh-huh.
So I ducked out and got them a bridesmaid. You know who it was?
Who?
Kate Smith. Miss Smith.
Needless to say, hello, everybody. I was just going to say, needless to say, I was quite thrilled to be able to be the matron of honor at this lovely wedding. I want you children to know how happy I was to have been here with you, and I wish you the best of success and happiness and good health and everything that goes with it.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Bill, I hope you two of you will have a long and happy life together.
Hey, Bill. Tell me something, Bill. When you were over on the other side, you weren't always happy, were you?
Heck no, I got lonely.
You mean you got lonely once in a while for Sandy?
That's right.
Well, you did want a song from Kate tonight, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
All right, now I'll tell you what we'll do. She's going to sing a little song that, believe me, you'll never have to sing as long as you live from now on in. And the title of this little thing that she's going to sing just for you so that you can laugh at it is I'm a Little on the Lonely Side Tonight. So you take it, Captain.
I'm a little on the lonely, a little on the lonely side. I keep thinking of you only and wishing you were by my side. You know, my dear, when you're not here, there's no one to romance with. And if I'm found with someone else, what you send me. I read a dozen times or more. Any wonder that I love you more and more? Oh, how I miss that tender kiss and long to hold you tight. I'm a little on the lonely side tonight.
Now, Kate, you've been at this club for 15 years. What is your reaction to seeing it filled with GIs?
Well, I will say this, Ed. Of all the years that I've been coming here, and I have been coming to the club about 12 years, the only change I see in the club are the boys in uniform instead of the members who used to be here. And they look very happy. And I'd say it's a wonderful change for them. And as long as they're happy, then I say they should have the club in their possession as long as they need it to use. Because God knows there isn't anything that we could do to repay them for what they've done for us.
Thank you very, very much, Kate.
Don't forget, tune in next week for Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Good night, folks.
So long, everybody.
Be sure to join Vox Pop next Monday night, friends. And remember, next time an ordinary headache strikes, get three-way relief fast.
Wide headache, three-way.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Vox Pop, on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBS episode from July 16, 1945. At the time of that episode, it had been on radio for 11 years and was part of CBS Radio's Monday night lineup at 8 o'clock. Over 14.5 million people were tuned in for that broadcast. You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for an episode of a relatively obscure series called Ports of Call. Syndicated in 1936, this episode takes us to Chile.
Ports of Call.
Beyond blue horizons, far at the world's end, strange, fascinating lands beckon us, bid us revel in their exotic splendors. Come with us as we head for Ports of Call. Lashed by the pounding Pacific, baked hot by dry tropic winds from the north, the Republic of Chile extends along the west coast of South America like a narrow sword with a curved point. Following the long, ragged coastline, our ship arrives at Valparaiso, a gay, busy metropolis built on varying levels, which are connected by corkscrew roads and electric elevators. Here we leave the ship to journey to Santiago, the capital of Chile. We speed to Santiago in clean electric cars, and gazing from the window, we see vast vineyards, cactus prodding its spines into walls of tiled adobe, round mud ovens, men in bright colored ponchos toiling by the roadside. Year 1543. The little village of Santiago nestles in the hot, fertile valley of Quillota. Before the comandante's hut stands Don Pedro de Valdivia, clad in bright armor. By his side, her chestnut hair shimmering in the morning sun, is a woman. A beautiful woman with eyes green as polished emerald. She is Doña Inés Sores, who with Don Pedro, 2 years before, had founded Santiago.
The day has come, Inez. I must depart for the seacoast.
Will you be gone long?
Perhaps several months.
But you will return. Oh, I cannot forget that you have a wife in Spain.
Oh, my darling. How can you doubt me? But I must build a ship so that we may transport gold to Peru. That is the king's command.
What if there should be trouble while you are gone? The Indians may try to take advantage of your absence.
The Indians will cause no trouble. I have thrown seven of their chiefs in prison. They will be kept in prison until I return. And my friend Felipe will watch over the village while I am gone.
I understand. If the Indians attack, their chiefs must die.
Just so. And on no condition shall those 7 chiefs be released. As long as they are in prison, Santiago is safe. But Felipe will attend to all that. Ah, there's Lautaro. I told him to come. You have packed all the supplies, Lautaro?
Everything is ready, Don Pedro.
Then wait with the horses. I will join you there. We start at once.
Yes, Don Pedro. I will be ready.
That Lautaro is a good servant.
But he is an Indian.
Oh, what of it? I must have someone to take care of
him. I don't trust him, Pedro.
You don't
trust
him? Yes. What possible reason could you have for not trusting Lautaro? He's been with me ever since...
If you are wise, you will get rid of him. Kill him. Send him back to his tribe. Do anything, but get rid of him.
Why? He has always been a faithful...
I've been watching Lautaro for many months. He is clever. And he has clear, black eyes that might belong to the devil. I've been meaning to speak to you about it. You will send the Indian away?
No. I will take him with me to the seacoast.
Then keep him. But someday you will find out that I spoke the truth. And then it may be too late. Come in.
Doña Inés.
Oh, Felipe, what do you want?
The Indian Lautaro is here. He wants to speak with you.
Lautaro? But he left for the coast of Don Pedro a week ago.
He returned tonight.
That's queer. Have him come in.
Come in, Lautaro.
Why are you here, Lautaro?
Don Pedro. He sent me.
Why does he send you?
Because Don Pedro was afraid my people might try to attack Santiago. That they might try to rescue the 7 caciques.
7 caciques?
Yes. The 7 Indian chiefs who have been put in prison.
The Indians will not dare an attack as long as we have their chiefs locked in prison. You know that.
I know only my order. Don Pedro sent me here with orders that the 7 chiefs be released. He came to me first, Doña Inés, but I did not want to release the prisoners without consulting you.
You are right in doing so, Felipe. The man is lying.
No, no.
Get out of here, Lautaro. Go back to your people. Tell them that the 7 chiefs will be held as hostages until Don Pedro returns. And if any attack is made on the town of Santiago, the 7 chiefs shall die.
But, Doña Inés, I am
telling
you...
Get out of this house. Be thankful that I spare you your life. If Don Pedro were here, you would hang to the highest tree. Don't stand there staring. Get out.
I go, Don Inés. I go.
There will be trouble, Don Inés. Perhaps we should have had him thrown in prison until...
That would have done no good. Toro is only one of many. But I'm afraid you're right, Felipe. There will be trouble.
I tell you, my comrades, it was that demon of a woman who ruined my plan. She knew that I was lying, that I had deserted Don Pedro. I think she even knew that we intend to destroy that accursed town.
We cannot destroy the town, Lautaro. What will happen to the 7 chiefs?
The Spaniards would not dare to kill them. They shall be rescued tonight. There will be no moon. We will attack quickly, and before the Spaniards are out of their beds, Santiago will be ours.
Doña Inés, the savages are battering at our gates. Lautaro is their leader. I saw him with my own eyes.
We cannot hold out much longer, Doña Inés.
As long as there is a man alive, we will defend Santiago.
Oh, if Don Pedro were only here.
But he's not here, and he won't be back for weeks.
Where are you going?
To the prison. Come along, Felipe.
To the prison?
I intend to keep my word to Lautaro. The 7 Indian chiefs shall pay forfeit for this attack with their lives.
Doña Inés, you do not intend
to... I intend to do just that. Open the door, Felipe.
Yes. Yes. But Doña Inés...
Listen to me, Felipe. Only one thing can keep those savages from destroying Santiago. Only one thing. Fear.
I do not understand.
The 7 prisoners must die. Their bodies must be thrown over the walls. When the Indians see that their chiefs have been killed, they will be terrified. And Lautaro will know that I spoke the truth.
Do you think it is wise?
It is our only chance. Where are the Indian prisoners?
They are chained over by that far wall. Here is a candle. I will carry it.
Place the candle on this table.
Yes.
Now, Don Felipe,
Draw your sword.
My sword? Oh, yes, my sword.
Well, what are you waiting for, Felipe?
I am to kill him in cold blood?
Why do you think I brought you here?
Oh, I can't do it, I can't do it.
Fool! I tell you, it's our only chance. Our lives, the lives of our men depend upon it. I helped build this town, helped to build it with my own hands. It belongs to me and to Spain. I won't see it destroyed by savages.
I can't.
Don, Felipe, give me the sword.
What?
Give me the sword. Your hand is trembling. Look at mine. The sword is steady in my hand.
You? A woman?
A woman? No, a Spaniard, Don Felipe, a Spaniard! My Pedro, that was the only thing that saved Santiago. When the enemy saw that their chiefs had been killed, the attack stopped almost at once. The Indians ran away in terror.
You are a brave woman, Inez.
Oh, but I'm sick of strife and bloodshed. Let us pray that there will be no more war. Let us remain side by side and build Santiago into a great city.
Alas, my darling, that is impossible.
Pedro, what do you mean?
This letter. It came today from the king.
The king?
I must never see you again, Inez. The king has ordered it.
Never see me again?
The king has decreed that all married men in Chile must send for their wives. As you know, I have a wife in Spain.
But Pedro, you love me. You've told me that you love me.
I am a soldier. I must obey the king's command.
It isn't fair. I was the only woman who dared come to Chile. I wanted to help you carve a new country out of this wilderness. What other woman would have done the things I've done?
No one.
These hands, look at them. They've become hard from toil, scarred with the marks of battle. I know that I've been cruel, heartless. But I was fighting for Spain and for you. I've earned my happiness. They can't take it away from me. They can't.
Felipe is waiting outside for me, Inez. To stay longer would only make parting more difficult. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Don't take to that, dear. May God go with you.
We must stop here, Felipe. My horse can go no farther. I think we'll be safe in this forest.
I hope those savages are not on our trail, Don Pedro. If you want my opinion, I think we should return to Santiago.
We're out of danger now. Tie your horse to this tree.
The attack that night came so suddenly, I hardly knew what had happened. We were lucky to escape with our lives. Why must we journey to Peru?
The king's orders.
So, you are never to see Doña Inés again?
Never.
A strange, beautiful woman. Cruel, yet loving.
I love her too, Felipe. Life will be very dreary.
Don Pedro, I see something moving. Over there, behind that clump of brush. We are trapped,
surrounded. Warriors with spears, they're everywhere.
Oh, Don Pedro!
Felipe!
Juan Bono! Do not move, Don Pedro, or I shall have my warrior kill you too.
Lotaro. You.
Yes, it is I, Lotaro. Your servant no longer. Now I am chief of my tribe. I have waited long for this moment.
What are you going to do with me?
We have been expecting you, my friend. Our camp is only a short distance away, and you came straight to us.
What are you going to do?
We shall give you supper. If only the Dona Inez were here. It would be pleasant to dine with the conqueror of Elida and his lady.
Lotaro, would you defy the great father, the king of Spain?
For my people? Yes. All the white man cares about is gold. Mala, have you brought the cup?
Here, Lotaro.
What is in that cup?
Gold, Don Pedro. Molten gold that has been waiting for you many hours. Simmering over a fire. Gold is the food of the Spaniard. Here it is. Hot, molten gold. Drink your fill. Drink your fill.
Today, on the granite heights above the city of Santiago, stands a statue of Don Pedro de Valdivia. But Inés Sores, the warrior's lady, remains only a mysterious figure on the musty pages of time. But it is said that sometimes, when the yellow moon is high above the Andes, a woman with chestnut hair and glittering green eyes is seen at Don Pedro's side. She is clad in armor, and she gazes longingly at the city which she helped to build. Perhaps it is only a legend, or it may be an apparition formed by the night mists billowing through the valley. Or perhaps it is the ghost of Doña Inez, seeking solace by the side of her departed lover. From Santiago, we travel back to the seacoast. Boarding our ship again, we head for an island west of the mainland. The island of Masatierra is a green splotch of land shaped like a half moon set in blue ocean. Here, an event took place that was destined to make this spot one of the best known islands in the world. Let us go back to September 1704. A British merchantman is anchored in the curved bay. Standing on her deck is hot-tempered young Alexander Selkirk.
I won't sail on this ship another day, Captain Spratling.
I should hang you for mutiny, Selkirk.
Go ahead, hang me. We haven't had decent rations for 3 months. The rest of the crew feel like I do, but they're afraid to stick up for their rights.
Aren't you afraid, Selkirk?
I'm not afraid of anything. I'd rather die than sail under a captain like you.
All right, you've asked for it, you'll get it. I'll put you off on this island with an axe, a matchlock, and a little gunpowder.
And my books.
Yes, you'll need something to occupy your mind from now on.
That suits me.
You know, we only stopped here to fill our water casks. Another ship may not drop anchor here for years.
I'll take a chance on it.
You're a headstrong fool. But there won't be anyone for you to quarrel with here. You'll have plenty of time to meditate. Plenty of time. Maybe the rest of your life.
Months, months into years, and Alexander Selkirk remained marooned on this deserted island. Then, on the 31st of January, 1709, a British vessel sailed into the bay. A boat was lowered, and First Mate Thomas Dover, accompanied by one of the seamen, went ashore.
If you ask me, Mr. Dover, I don't like this business, tromping through underbrush that might be full of snakes and wild animals and all sorts of...
There are no snakes on this island. And you'll not find any animals except wild dogs and goats.
What are we looking for?
We saw a light burning on the shore last night. The skipper thought we'd better investigate.
Maybe there's cannibals on this island.
Ah, nonsense.
Before I left London, my wife, she says to me, here, Mr. Dover.
What do you see?
Blimey, footprints. Men's footprints.
Aye. And they lead through those bushes. Come on.
Right behind you, sir.
Look. Straight ahead. Isn't that a cave?
If it ain't, I'm balmy. It's got a gate built up in front of it. And the gate is opening.
Someone's coming out. A man. Dressed in goat skin.
Fierce looking bloke, ain't he? Look at that beard.
Hello. Hello.
Maybe he ain't got no tongue. Can't you talk, mister?
Who are you?
I'm Thomas Dover, mate of the English privateer, Duke. We saw a light burning here last night.
Well, that was my fire. I light it every night, hoping that some ship will see it.
Well, what are you doing here?
Waiting to be rescued. 4 years, I haven't spoken to a soul. I've lived here, in this cave.
You won't have to live here any longer, old man. We're taking you aboard, back to England.
England?
Ain't you never heard of it?
Yes. England. England.
And Mrs. Selkirk, you say every word of your story is true?
Yes, Mr. Defoe, every word of it.
You lived in a cave for 4 years, made your own clothes out of goat skins, and...
That's right. My only companions were my books and my dog.
And a parrot that are caught in a trap.
A very interesting story. I wonder if I might use it in a book that I am writing.
A book?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm a writer. Daniel Defoe. Perhaps you've read my... I keep forgetting. You've just recently returned.
Well, if you can use my story, you're welcome to it.
Oh, thank you. Of course, I'll have to change it a bit. And I won't use your name. I'll call you Robinson. Now, let me think. Robinson Crusoe. That's it. The life and adventures of Robinson Crusoe.
Such was the story of Alexander Selkirk, the real Robinson Crusoe. As we visit Masatierra, we see a marble tablet set against the rocks, a tribute to the man who made the island famous. But the years have brought a great change to Masatierra. It has become a prosperous fishing port, and only recently the Chilean government declared it a national park. High radio towers flash messages to many ships which now pass these shores. But to many a boy and girl throughout the world, Robinson Crusoe's island will always remain deserted. The last outpost of romance and adventure. Returning to the mainland of Chile, we sail northward past angular pinnacles and cliffs which overlook the sea. The land has become hot, barren, brown. No grass or vegetation of any kind grows on this forbidding coast. We are in the nitrate country, source of Chile's greatest wealth. Entering the port of Iquique, we see automobiles twisting and turning up the desolate mountainside, windshields sparking like flashes of golden fire in the afternoon sunlight. And over the dreary reddish hill lies the nitrate mine, where steam shovels bite into the arid soil and dig out the precious caliche. 58 years ago, a dispute over this nitrate-bearing land caused war between Chile and the combined forces of Bolivia and Peru. The War of the Pacific was renowned as a naval war, and one of the first battles took place here in the Bay of Iquique. May 21st, 1879, the Chilean warship Esmeralda is sailing from Iquique. A short distance away, coming toward the Esmeralda like a sleek greyhound, is the crack Peruvian battleship Auscar. On the bridge of the Esmeralda, we find Chile's young naval officer, Captain Arturo Pratt. He peers at the enemy through his binoculars and speaks to his lieutenant.
Lieutenant Uribe, the cannon are charged and ready?
Yes, Captain. But every gun on this ship should have been in the scrap heap long ago. Looks like we are in for a bad day, Captain.
You're nervous, Uribe.
Who would not be nervous? Look at the gun turret on that Peruvian. One good broadside from those guns, and it will be the end of the Esmeralda.
Come here, Uribe. You see that flag with a single star in the field of blue flying at our masthead? That flag has never been hauled down. It will never be struck while I am captain of the Esmeralda. But if something should happen to me, you would be next in command.
I promise you, sir, those colors shall remain at the masthead as long as this ship stays afloat.
That's all I wanted to know. Now go forward, Uribe. Take charge of the gunner. I'll give my commands from the bridge.
Aye, aye, sir.
Stand by your post, men! Stand by!
Aye, aye, sir!
Aye, aye, sir. Fire at will!
Aye, aye, sir!
Hour upon hour, the rattling roar of cannon shatters the peaceful morning, turning the Esmeralda into a mass of crumpled rails, broken stanchions, and splintered wood. Then, with a quick maneuver, the Peruvian ship rams its steel-plated bow into the Esmeralda's bulging side. With a grinding, rending crash, both vessels locked together. Suddenly, a man is seen poised on the Esmeralda's main deck. It is Captain Arturo Pratt. Sword and pistol drawn, he leaps aboard the enemy ship.
Come on, boys! Here's our chance! Porter, follow me!
His men start to follow, but before they can jump to the enemy deck, both ships swing wide apart. A burst of fire cracks from the enemy turret. The captain's sword glitters high in the air. A limp body lurches forward.
They've killed him! They've killed him!
Back to your gun, Riquelme! Keep firing! Keep firing!
Hours drag by. The wounded ship settles lower and lower into the water. At last, the clamor of battle fades. Nothing is left of the Esmeralda but a shattered prow and one lone cannon.
We are the only ones left, Riquelme.
Yes, Lieutenant.
But we still have one gun. Is it charged?
Wait, I'll see.
Yes. Yes.
It is charged and ready to fire.
Then aim it well.
and let the shot be our last salute.
To Chile.
Our last salute. I said we would fight as long as there was one gun left. And this is it, Lieutenant. This is it.
Thus, drunk with glory, Midshipman McKelmy fires the final shot, and the battered, broken corvette sinks beneath the waves. But the flag of Chile, with its one bright white star clinging to the foremast, is the last to disappear. And so it happened that the men of Chile proved themselves glorious even in defeat. But the loss of the Esmeralda was avenged, for Chile conquered both Peru and Bolivia and took possession of the great nitrate fields of South America. The valuable nitrates of Iquique have been stored into the hold of our ship, and we are now ready to depart from Chile. To see all of these strange mountainous country would take months, perhaps years. For beyond the mountain ranges lies a vast desert, once an ocean bed, but now filled with the remains of petrified sea animals and stone lizards, all sparkling weirdly in the blazing sun. And high in the snow-capped Andes, a railroad burrows its way through rocky clefts like a long, shining serpent. Although it is a modern country, with airports, golf courses, theaters, and factories, Chile is like a precious, uncut stone, which needs only the polishing hand of time to bring out its true richness and beauty. And so we leave you, Chile. Hard, brilliant, glamorous. A land inhabited by the wanderers of four centuries, who have made you their final port of call.
Ports of Call, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1936, bringing to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.